with Katie Turner. I'm the Education and Programming Coordinator here at Crouse Financial. Today's topic is Understanding the Basics of Medicaid Compliant Annuity Planning, hosted by Alice Thompson, our Sales Director here at Crouse Financial. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as this is a CLE requirement in order for you to receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Alex, I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you, Katie. Again, my name is Alex Thompson. I am the sales director at Crouse. This is year 10 for me with the company, and I spent the first 5 years as a benefits planner, primarily devising spend down plans for attorneys and their clients before moving into my current position where I oversee the planning team and business development team. So today's topic is understanding the basics of Medicaid compliance annuity planning. In simple terms, the MCA is going to convert excess resources into an income stream in a way that helps the client qualify for Medicaid sooner. And we'll dive into how it can be used to plan accordingly later on. But before we get into that, we're going to give a little bit of a background for those of you who are not familiar with Crouse. So Crouse is an attorney-led firm that provides asset preservation solutions for estate planning and elder law attorneys, primarily through the use of specialized insurance products. That main product that we use is going to be the Medicaid compliant annuity, but we also have other product offerings such as long-term care insurance, funeral expense trusts, and whole life insurance policies. In addition to those planning products that we have, we also have a wealth of resources in form of knowledge base, and we also have a specialized team that helps support attorneys as they navigate the pitfalls of Medicaid planning post-Medicaid application. Our office has been doing this for over 30 plus years. We have over 40 professionals on staff, and we average well over 400 MCA cases per month. Now, as we dive into today's topic, I keep saying MCA. That is going to be the Medicaid compliant annuity. So there are a couple of Crouse-isms that I'll do my best to step back from it and explain, but just want to make sure that is readily apparent. And before I move on to the next slide, I want to reiterate that our primary mission is to empower those legal professionals to navigate the long-term care planning needs of their clients with confidence. Because this is such a niche area, there's so much to know and there's so much to learn. So we really do our best to make sure that attorneys are well equipped to put their clients in the best possible position to have the best outcome. Today's goal, we're going to discuss the basic requirements of the Medicaid program. We are going to identify how the Medicaid compliant annuity is utilized to accelerate eligibility for benefits. And then lastly, we're going to walk through two case studies illustrating the Medicaid compliant annuity in action. One would be for a married couple, and the other would be for a single client. So let's talk about the Medicaid program. What is it? Well, Medicaid is a joint federal and state program that is designed for individuals with limited means. Primary goal of Medicaid is to prevent impoverishment of the applicants. Applicants, however, must meet very specific financial and non-financial criteria in order to qualify, and we'll walk through with what those financial and non-financial criteria are later on in the presentation. The last thing to remember when we're talking about Medicaid programming is that while it is a joint federal and state program, each state has their own set of rules and applications. So what might be true for one state isn't necessarily true for another state. We're going to cover the basics and we'll apply the majority to the most of what we're going to discuss today, but know that there are some subtle nuances from state to state. Why is Medicaid important? Well, when we look at the semi-private room rate, of $9,277 per month and a private roommate of $10,646 per month, you can see pretty quickly that someone might deplete their assets awfully fast. And if they have limited income, which most people do, all of that monthly shortfall is going to have to come out of their assets that they've accumulated throughout their life's work. And while they're on Medicaid, Medicaid is going to pay for a person's custodial care. So qualifying for Medicaid benefits is really going to be something that is going to help them provide financial relief to make sure that they don't deplete their assets immediately. So the non-financial requirements of Medicaid are limited to three things. In order to meet Medicaid's non-financial eligibility requirement, they have to be a U.S. citizen or qualified non-citizen. They must be age 65 or older, blind or disabled. And lastly, they must reside in a Medicaid-approved facility. Those three requirements are absolute. They can't have two of the requirements and not meet the third and still qualify for Medicaid. And that last point, Medicaid-approved facility, is a pretty important one because it doesn't matter if they have all the other attributes or they're potentially going to be in a Medicaid-approved facility if there's not a Medicaid-approved bed that's available to them. So when we talk about nursing home care versus assisted living waiver or assisted living care, typically those assisted living facilities, they may have Medicaid beds, but there's normally a lengthy wait list that would prevent them from being eligible first. Income requirements for an institutionalized individual or single person are going to be different than the income requirements for a married spouse that resides in the community. So we'll cover the institutionalized individual's income requirements first. And in most states, the institutionalized person's income from their earned and unearned sources has to be less than what the private pay rate of the facility is. In order to qualify for that financial need component, they can't have income in excess of the cost of care because there is no financial need for it if they're able to pay with their monthly income. Some states do require a qualified income trust, also known as a Miller Trust, for income, and that's only if the amount exceeds $2,982, and roughly half of the states are going to have that requirement. The qualified income trust is just going to be an account that the income needs to pass through in order to pay the facility. Lastly, the institutionalized person's income, once they're on Medicaid, becomes their Medicaid copay. So whatever their monthly income is, less what their personal needs allowance is, which is usually in the range of $50 to $100, depending on the state, is going to go towards Medicaid. If they are married, there might be a situation where they could have an income shift through the monthly maintenance needs allowance rules, otherwise known as the MIMNA rules. But anything in excess of that is just going to become their Medicaid copay. So now that we've talked about an institutionalized individual, we'll cover the income components on a community spouse. Good news, there are no limits on the income of a community spouse. That means that the community spouse can have as much income as they want or as much income as they need, and they can still qualify the institutionalized spouse for Medicaid benefits. While Medicaid does not have a fixed number for income, we typically recommend a conservative number or something that is not going to be considered excessive. However, if their income is below a certain amount, they would be eligible to have an income shift through that MIMNA. All that means is if the income is less than the threshold, they're able to have that portion shifted over from their institutionalized spouse. We'll cover that a little bit later too. So the monthly maintenance needs allowance is going to be the amount of income that community spouse is entitled to. Now, some states recognize a minimum, which is usually $2,643.75. and a maximum, which is $4,066 in most states. These are usually pulled from the Social Security standards. And all that means is that if you have a community spouse with a low amount of income, we'll say $1,000, and their community spouse has $3,000, and the community spouse has excessive monthly shelter expenses, there's a financial need for it, she would be entitled to have an income transfer from the institutionalized spouse to her income to raise it to that floor of $2,643.75. Depending on what those monthly expenses are, she might be able to have an even higher amount up to that ceiling figure. Now, there are a handful of states that also recognize a standard MMDA, which is usually capped at the ceiling, so $4,066.50. And if their income is less than that amount, it's a nice, clean transaction because there is no calculating from what their monthly shelter needs are. It's just her income less the $4,066. That's going to be the amount that she's able to receive from her institutionalized spouse. Now that we've covered the income requirements, we'll dive into the asset requirements. For an institutionalized individual, the Medicaid recipient is going to be allowed to keep $2,000 in most states. That means that anything in excess of $2,000 must be spent down. For a community spouse, they have what is called the Community Spouse Resource Allowance, which is a significantly higher figure. The main takeaway to keep in mind from this is that once eligibility is achieved, state Medicaid agency has no considerations for the community spouse's assets at the time of renewal. Let's dive into what that Community Spouse Resource Allowance is. Well, the Community Spouse Resource Allowance, otherwise known as the CESRA, is going to be the amount of countable assets that the community spouse may keep. Similar to the MMDA, some states are going to recognize a minimum, which is currently $32,532, and a maximum, which is currently $162,660. So if you have a client that has $100,000, they are going to look at what their assets were as of the snapshot date. And the snapshot date is going to be the first of 30 continuous days of institutionalization. And they're going to cut that figure in half. So $50,000 would be fitting right in the range of that minimum and maximum. That's how much that she can keep. If you have a client that has $40,000, well, half of that figure is $20,000. Because that's less than the floor, she'd be entitled to keep $32,532. And the same works for if you have a client that has considerable assets, say $500,000, you know, they're not able to keep half of that because that amount is in excess of that cap. There are several states too that recognize the standard CESRA, which is usually the cap or $162,660. And assets at that must be at least that amount in order for them to have that shift. So the snapshot date is more relevant than that because there is no calculation of dividing the assets in half. It's whatever their assets are at the time of the application. If they're above that, they need to spend it down. So now we'll cover some of the exempt and countable assets. Exempt assets simply don't count towards one's resource allowance. Those are primarily going to consist of primary residence, a vehicle, personal belongings, small life insurance policy, and funeral expense trusts. That usually is capped at $15,000 for the last one, the funeral expense trust. However, that also ranges from state to state. Some states have it at $10,000. Most of them are capping that at $15,000. there's one state that it comes to top of mind, which is Pennsylvania, that has a $30,000 cap, but that ranges from county to county. So just know that it's a range. On the other side, countable assets simply count towards one's resource allowance, and those are going to be checking account, savings account, other bank accounts, any of their investments, stocks, bonds, deferred annuities, and real property and additional vehicles. IRAs in most states are countable. However, that also is dependent on who owns the IRA and what RMD status they're in. So there are several states that will exempt IRAs if they're in RMD stage. And more importantly, if it's owned by the community spouse, more likely to exempt it than if it is for the institutionalized spouse. So how do they eliminate that spend down amount? Well, they have several options. They can pay off their mortgage, any outstanding balances, credit card debt. They can purchase other exempt assets, such as, you know, getting a new roof, getting a new car, upgrading their home and personal belongings. They can also utilize that funeral expense trust, which we just talked about. But the main primary tool that we use at our office is going to be the MCA. So let's talk about the MCA. Why is it such a valuable planning tool? Before we talk about it, we need to understand what it is. And the Medicaid-compliant annuity is an income-only, single-premium, immediate annuity that is designed to work specifically within Medicaid's program requirements. At its core, it's going to convert excess countable assets into an income stream with zero cash value. Once an annuity is annuitized, it has zero cash value. And when that's properly structured, the MCA is going to help the client accelerate Medicaid eligibility while also protecting their assets. There are five requirements in order for the annuity to be Medicaid compliant. The first, it has to be irrevocable. This simply means that the payment term, parties to the contract, beneficiaries cannot be altered or modified. Secondly, it has to be non-assignable. This means that it cannot be transferred to another party or sold on the secondary market. And I want to pause here just because the irrevocable nature of the product and non-assignable nature of the product make it such a final purchase. There's so much finality that's associated with this product that in order for it to be structured correctly, everyone needs to have their affairs in order before it's purchased. Because once it's in place, there's really no going back. They do have the free look period in which a client has an opportunity to review the policy that they've purchased and make changes, but that is going to vary from state to state, carrier to carrier. You're usually talking about 10 days up to 30 days at most. And once it's put in place and that free look period has expired, there's no going back. So now that I've given my little detour on that, we'll jump into the third requirement, which is it has to be actuarially sound. So actuarially soundness, the definition will vary for a handful of states, but at its core, it simply means that the term of the annuity has to be equal to or less than the owner's Medicaid life expectancy. I also want to highlight that Medicaid life expectancy is not to be confused with their current prognosis and what their current life expectancy is. So Medicaid life expectancy is usually going to be pulled from the Social Security Administration tables. Those are usually updated every January or April. And those are usually pulled from a prior year's trustees report. There are a handful of states that have their own state-specific life expectancy tables. However, the vast majority of those are pulling from a prior version of the SSA tables. The fourth requirement is that each payment must be equal and level. They cannot provide for a deferral or balloon payment. Prior to the Deficit Reduction Act, balloon speeds were fairly popular. You would have a annuity that is purchased that makes small monthly payments, and then that last payment is the lump sum. And they would primarily do this to ensure that there's an income shift through the MIMDA transfer. But that kind of planning hasn't been relevant or permissible in quite some time. The last requirement is that the state has to be named as primary beneficiary to the amount of benefits that they've provided on behalf of the Medicaid recipient. The only caveat that I'll throw on this is that it is largely dependent on who is purchasing the annuity. If the institutionalized individual is purchasing the annuity, unless they have a minor or disabled child, or if they have a well spouse that resides in the community, the state is going to be in a primary position. Most states will allow for those three exceptions to be listed as primary if it's applicable, and then the state is contingent. But 99% of the time, we are seeing the state listed as primary beneficiary, and then loved ones are in a contingent position. So how do we fund the MCA? Well, it boils down to two funding methods. The first is very straightforward, pretty simple, non-qualified funds or post-tax funds. This simply means that funds that have already been taxed, all that they need to do is provide a check. It could be a personal check, could be cashier's check. We'll also accept wires or ACH. And they just need to include that with the MCA application. Now it says here, quick turnaround time, typically 5 business days. That is on the conservative side. The vast majority of the time, we are seeing a turnaround time of 2 to 3 business days. But as we approach the end of the month, because everyone is just trying to get their Medicaid applications in, that 5 business day turnaround time becomes more apparent. But it's largely dependent on the time of the month that the application is submitted. So again, beginning of the month, much faster. End of the month, more like that 5 business day turnaround time. So let's dive into the tax qualified fund, which are not as straightforward as we would like. Clients essentially have 2 funding options when dealing with tax qualified funds. They can utilize a trustee-to-trustee transfer, which is going to consist of the client's submitted transfer paperwork along with the MCA application. From that point, the new company, MCA company, is going to initiate the transfer request on the client's behalf. And that process can typically take anywhere from 2 weeks up to a month, month and a half. It is largely dependent on the existing custodian company and what kind of time frames and parameters they have in place. The other option they have would be to utilize what is called a 60-day rollover. This option is going to have the client request a distribution of the account without tax withholdings, and then the custodian company will then issue the check to the client. Client will receive it, deposit it into their account, and then issue a new check payable to the new MCA provider. While the 60-day rollover is significantly faster in most cases, the downside of this is twofold. First, that's an extra step, an extra communication and planning for the client, because they need to be made aware that they are going to have funds that they're going to have to manage. And secondly, the IRS is going to say that only 1 60-day rollover is permissible per year. And that's not per calendar year, it's per 365 days. When we get to trying to figure out what is the best approach, it's largely going to be dependent on the time of the month again. If we're at the beginning of the month and we have time to plan, and the trustee-to-trustee transfer just seems cleaner, we're probably going to go with that route. When it gets to be under a more of a time crunch, that 60-day rollover becomes significantly more appealing if the goal is to obtain Medicaid eligibility in the current month. The last thing I want to point out with trustee-to-trustee transfers and 60-day rollovers is just making sure that the custodian company has a record of any power of attorney documents, because what can significantly slow down either option is a POA makes the requests and then the custodian company has to submit that paperwork because they weren't aware of it to their legal department. And that oftentimes slows things down by at least a few days, if not longer. Again, each custodian company is going to have their own internal processes and timeframes, which can ultimately negatively or positively impact your client. What is the benefit of utilizing tax qualified funds? It's going to allow the client to fund their MCA with their retirement account and offset the immediate tax consequences. Instead of getting taxed immediately, they're going to be able to spread out that tax hit over the duration of their annuity term. When is the MCA appropriate? First, they have to be in a Medicaid-approved facility, and they have to be expected to remain there indefinitely. So if you have a family that has a client or family member that is maybe in between, they're not really sure, I probably wouldn't recommend pulling the trigger on the MCA. Once we know that they're going to be there and they're not expected to return home, then we can have that conversation. The other component of this is they typically have to exhaust all their other benefits, whether it's long-term care insurance or Medicare benefits. The third component of it is that they're paying out of pocket for care. And the last one is that they have assets that exceed that Medicaid limitation. The MCA really shouldn't be a pre-planning tool. It should really be the last purchase that they make. Due to the finality of the product, you wouldn't want to have someone that buys the annuity several months in advance prior to actually needing it, because if their situation changes, well, now they're stuck with it. They can't modify it. There's no cash value to it. They can't change anything on it. So now we'll dive into what a married couple case would look like. The most common planning strategy for a married couple is going to consist of the community spouse converting their spend down amount and putting it into the MCA to obtain immediate eligibility. So again, primary goals on utilizing this strategy would be to accelerate benefits, qualify immediately the institutionalized spouse, and then also provide reliable monthly income to the community spouse, which would help them provide a little bit of a safeguard against any unexpected expenses and spousal impoverishment. We see roughly 30% of cases that come through our office on a monthly basis are going to use this particular planning strategy. So let's meet Patrick and Sally. Patrick's 82. He's recently entered a nursing home, and cost of care is $9,500 a month, while his wife, Sally, also 82, is concerned about losing their life savings while paying for Patrick's care. So she reaches out to a local elder law attorney for help. As a recap, his cost of care is $9,500. His income is $2,600. Her income is $2,200. So right off the bat, I can see that they have a monthly shortfall in excess of $4,000. And with total assets of $415,000, they're going to have to dip into those funds immediately just to maintain a monthly cost of care. So planning time, what do they do? Well, inaction is an action within itself, so they could decide to do nothing. And again, with his cost of care at $9,500 a month, they are at risk of depleting those assets in as little as 43 months. So you take what her current countable assets are of $415,000, divide by the monthly cost of care at $9,500, and that is going to result in a clock of zero funds left and 43.68 months. In addition to that, the more that they pay for his nursing home care, the less that is available for Sally to manage those unexpected surprises that come up. And not only that, but also maintain her standard of living. So you'll hear us say fairly often, time is of the essence, and that's not just alluding to Medicaid application deadline dates or annuity application deadline dates. That also is symbolic of the planning style, because the longer that they delay, the less that they have available to them. So the next step would be to determine the appropriate spend out amount. So we know that she can keep her personal belongings, family home, her car, and up to $162,606 as part of her community spouse resource allowance. And again, because they had total assets of $415,000, she's entitled to keep the ceiling figure, which is at $162,000 figure. But you'd like to plan at least a little bit conservatively. So instead of keeping the full amount, we're going to give ourselves a little bit of a cushion just in case there's any surprises. And instead, she's going to keep $160,000 for her community spouse resource allowance. Patrick is still entitled to keep his $2,000 for his resource allowance. So together, they have $162,000 that they're going to keep for this plan. So we subtract that amount from her total countable assets of $415,000 to give us our spend down amount of $253,000. So now that we've determined the spend down amount, the next item would be to determine the appropriate MCA length. So this ties back to the actuarial soundness requirement. We know that because she is 82 years of age, her Medicaid life expectancy is 8.34 years or 100.08 months. So again, Medicaid actuarial soundness requires them to have a term that is equal to or shorter than the annuity's owner's Medicaid life expectancy. So therefore, she's going to utilize a term that does not exceed 100 months. And I also want to throw two other key considerations when we evaluate which term is appropriate. Her current health is going to dictate whether we want to be a little more aggressive with the payment term or more conservative. Because if their health is poor, well, we want to accelerate the payouts so that they can preserve as many assets as possible. The other consideration is what is her standard monthly needs. If you have a client that has a very modest lifestyle and they have good health, well, you might want to go with a longer term. And if the goal is to get an income shift through the MIMNA, that's certainly something they could elect to do. In this case, Sally and the attorney have decided to utilize a 48-month term. So we'll purchase the annuity with a premium of $253,000 for a 4-year term, and each month is going to pay $5,300 for a total payout of $254,400. There is a little bit of interest on these annuities. It's pretty nominal, but the interest component is not the goal. The goal is Medicaid eligibility, and I would advise that to your clients as well. Sally is going to be the owner and payee. The state is going to be named as primary beneficiary for benefits they've provided on behalf of her spouse, Patrick. And then her kids are going to be the contingent beneficiaries. The next step is to apply for Medicaid. So after purchasing the MCA, her income is going to bump up from $2,200 a month to $7,500 a month. And now that spend down amount that they had has been eliminated, and Patrick is immediately eligible for Medicaid. What happens to his income? Well, his income less that $75 personal needs allowance is going to become his Medicaid copay. And that personal needs allowance, again, is going to range from $50 to $100 in most states, that is utilized for them to have some of their own personal, be able to pay for some of their own personal needs, whether it's a haircut or Snickers, candy bar, whatever it is, as long as they have that $75 to pull from, they can use that fund, those funds for that. Economic results from this, again, he achieves immediate eligibility, but when you compare that, what he was previously paying at $9,500 a month compared to what his new Medicaid copay is of $2,525, they are saving just under $7,000 a month. And conversely, during that annuity payout term, Sally's monthly income has increased to $7,500 a month, which is again, more than she would have received under the MIMNA rules alone. And that gives her a little bit of a cushion in case anything happens unexpectedly. She's not just solely relying on the assets that are sitting in the bank for her resource allowance. She can pay, hopefully, with the excess income that she has each month from the annuity. And again, want to highlight that as payments accumulate each month in their bank account, Patrick's Medicaid eligibility is not at risk because only his assets are considered by the state at the time of renewal. Additional considerations. There's always a catch. This sounds like an awesome plan, and it truly is. But there are a couple of things that could potentially happen that could derail the plan. The first would be if Sally were to need Medicaid care, what happens to her monthly payments? Well, one of two things is going to happen. The first is if her income is less than the cost of care at her new facility, it would just become part of her monthly copay. The other scenario would be if her income now exceeds the private pay rate of the new facility, she would not be eligible for Medicaid. Alternatively, if she were to pass away while the annuity is still in a payout period, those remaining funds might be recovered by the state Medicaid agency because they were listed as primary beneficiary. The claims process tends to be a lengthy one. I've seen 3 months, 6 months, 1 year. Normally, the states aren't in a huge hurry to settle a claim, which can certainly add some friction and frustration for the contingent beneficiaries because they're kind of left in the lurch waiting to find out what is left over to them. It's also further complicated by the fact that if the institutionalized spouse is still living, they might keep that claim still open. So from a timing standpoint, I would just make sure that your client is aware that if the state is named as primary, there can be a bit of a weight on the back end. Now that we've covered a married couple, we'll dive into the single person case study. What is the most common planning strategy for a single person? That would be a gift and MCA plan, otherwise known as a half a loaf plan. This plan consists of an individual gifting roughly half their assets to a family member or loved one, intentionally creating that penalty period. And with the other half of their funds, they are going to put that into the MCA and use those monthly payments to privately pay throughout that penalty period. There are two goals with this strategy. The first is to accelerate Medicaid eligibility. And the second goal is to create that wealth transfer via divestment. To meet Judy. So Judy is 87 and she's a single person with dementia. Her family can no longer care for her, so they made the difficult decision to place her in a nursing home that costs $10,200 per month. After that first bill rolls in, her family decides to reach out to a local elder law attorney for help. Case facts on this one would be her cost of care is $10,200, her income is $2,550, and her penalty divestment divisor is going to be $9,500. She has total countable assets of $172,000. So right off the bat, I can see that she's got a monthly shortfall of in excess of $7,000. If she decides to do nothing with a cost of care of $10,200 a month, we divide that into her total countable assets. She's looking at spending down her life savings in 16.86 months, which is certainly a hard pill to swallow. And if this occurs, there is nothing left to pass on to her family. But Judy is not going to do this. She's going to devise the plan with the elder law attorney, and they are going to move forward on an MCA. First step that we need to take is to calculate what the spend down amount is. So Judy can keep her personal belongings and up to $2,000 for her individual resource allowance. Subtracting that from her total countable assets, that leaves us with a spend down amount of $170,000. So this is where the calculation gets a bit more complicated. What we'll do is we'll take her cost of care of $10,200, subtract her income of $2,550 to calculate what that income shortfall is. In this scenario, it's $7,650. And then we'll add that figure to that monthly divestment penalty divisor of $9,500. And that is going to give us what we consider the burn rate. Now, the burn rate is going to be 1 month's equivalent of paying a monthly shortfall while simultaneously paying through 1 month's equivalent of a penalty period. Each state has a different number for that divestment penalty divisor, and all that is the average monthly cost of care throughout the state. In some states, it's a little bit lower. Some states, it's a little bit higher, but it usually hovers around that $9,500 range. So where does the burn rate come into play? Well, we utilize the burn rate to calculate the baseline length of the plan. So to calculate this, we are going to divide the spend down amount by that burn rate. So $170,000 divided by the burn rate of $17,150 is going to give us our baseline plan length at 9.91 months. Now, going back to the annuity requirements by Medicaid, it has to be equal level payments. So that should be a reminder that you cannot structure a annuity with a fractional term. It has to be a whole month. And because we know that there's that financial necessity that they have to have income that is less than the cost of care, we may increase the penalty period or decrease the term to make sure that there's no income issue. So in this scenario, we round it up to 10 months. The calculation for the gift is pretty straightforward, fortunately for us. It's length of the plan of 10 months multiplied by the divestment penalty divisor of $9,500. That's going to give us the total plan length or total gift amount of $95,000. Because she gifts away that $95,000, state Medicaid agency is going to assess a 10-month penalty period for her. So the next step would be to purchase the MCA. After Judy makes that wealth transfer, her spend out amount is reduced by the gift. So $170,000 less the gift of $95,000 is going to leave us with $75,000 for her MCA. So she'll buy the MCA, structure it with a 10-month term, and each month it'll pay out $7,510 for a total payout of $75,100. Similar to the married couple that we had, owner is going to be Judy, pay is going to be Judy. She's also going to be the primary beneficiary of the state for benefits provided on her behalf, and her kids will be contingent beneficiary. We've made the gift. We've purchased the annuity. The next step is to apply for Medicaid. So she is now considered otherwise eligible, but for the gift, for Medicaid benefits. After she sends in that Medicaid application, her penalty period will start. And during this time, she's going to use her Social Security income and the MCA income to help her pay through that nursing home bill. And again, we want the monthly income to be less than the cost of care. So with her cost of care being $10,200, she's going to have a $140 monthly shortfall. From a timeline perspective, make the gift, purchase the MCA, submit the Medicaid application. And beginning month one, she has to privately pay through the nursing home during that penalty period. And at the conclusion of that 10-month penalty period, she's going to start receiving Medicaid benefits. We always want to, if we can, structure the annuity to run concurrent with the penalty period. We don't want to have it structured so that it's paying unnecessarily on the back end, or on the opposite side, paying too short of a duration. After that 10-month penalty period, her income is going to revert back to $2,550 because the annuity has exhausted itself. And once you factor in that $75 personal needs allowance, her Medicaid copay is going to be $2,475, which when you compare that to what she was privately paying before at $10,200, she's going to save $7,725 a month. On top of that, she's also successfully made a wealth transfer of $95,000 to her kids, which is actually a little bit more than the half a loaf plan. Each state and each client is going to be slightly different. Usually it fits in right around 50%, but it could be a little more, it could be a little less depending on how much they have. Additional considerations for this type of planning. If she were to pre-cease that 10-month plan, there's a wash for the benefits because she wouldn't have gained anything or lost anything because she was privately paying during that annuity term. The only caveat that I'll throw into this situation is if you have a client that was a prior Medicaid recipient, if the state is named as primary beneficiary and they paid before, well, then yes, they would be entitled to recoup for benefits. Usually we aren't seeing that scenario come up. It's not too often that it does, but normally you have a situation where a client was on Medicaid and then they received an inheritance and then they need to spend down those assets. They end up usually gifting those funds. And that's really the only situation that ever comes up that would trigger that impact. The second part of it is if her cost of care increases or she has any unexpected medical expenses, the kids would probably be expected to help chip in with some of the gifted funds to cover those costs. Alternatively, she might be able to dip into her individual resource allowance, but because that figure is $2,000, probably not going to be a whole lot left to cover that. And a conversation that I would recommend having with your clients is the longer the term, the larger the shortfall. And I would recommend earmarking a portion of those funds just in case anything happens so they don't spend it all. So I know we covered a lot of ground. We do have a little bit of time left if there are any questions. I don't see any questions here. So I'll leave you all with three primary takeaways. Medicaid planning has very strict income and asset rules. The MCA can help convert those excess assets into income to help accelerate eligibility while also preserving those assets. And lastly, married and single clients utilize very different planning strategies, and our office is certainly willing to help out your clients and devise the best plan that is suitable for them. If you do have any questions after this, please feel free to give us a call or shoot us an email. But that is time for today. I would encourage you to, or remind you to complete your surveys. And with that, thank you for joining. Have a wonderful afternoon.